Well, thank you for the invitation to be here. It's delightful once again to be part of this community. It is a while, and I hope that my being here and what I have to bring to this morning is a real sense of affirmation. Whilst I've brought to you something about somebody who has been trying to live a deeply spiritual life, I think it actually is a story about us. And it's a story about our spiritual journey. So this is not about look at her over there and what she does and shouldn't we do it like that. This is about what has she got to say to us that is affirming of our journey and where we're going. So looking at this weekend, I did look at the lectionary and lo and behold, up comes 2 Kings. And I was sort of half expecting that when the children came out, they'd been dressed up in chariots and horses, and but no. The story of in 2 Kings, I think, is really interesting, and I'm marrying these two parts of what I have to say this morning with Beverly Lanzetta's quest, ideas, with what we already know, what we already know from the scriptures. The scriptures are very clear about the sorts of things that Beverly Lanzetta also has to say. So what we're talking about is the human experience of people with God, with their God. It is not something that is out there. It's not some ecstatic emanation of something that we would never have any connection with. It is about us, and it's about us and our journey with our God. So the 2 Kings story is interesting because I'll just go through it a little bit here. And I find it really interesting because of the way in which the language and the way it's talked about. So here we have, and I really applaud Bobby's choice of the music this morning, and particularly Paul's lovely song about the still small voice is where we hear God. Because this comes just after that. Remember it doesn't just come after it, but in Kings, there is this wonderful story that we all tell about, no, God is not in the noise and the commotion and the doing and the being. He's in the quietness. And this sort of follows on from that. So when they crossed the Jordan, Elijah said to Elisha, tell me what I can do before I am taken from you. So this is Elijah asking his disciple, his fellow prophet, what can I do for you before I go? As an older person, you tell I'm older, something that's on the mind these days is, what have I done? What have I got to pass on? What have I left behind? Have I done anything? Was there anything worthwhile in my life? And I'm wondering if this is Elijah in this moment saying, what can I do? What do I have that I can give to you? And, of course, Elisha, who I presume is younger, very boldly, oh, give me all your wisdom. Give me the lot. Double portion. Elijah, in his wisdom, says, that's a bit tricky, son. That's a bit tricky. You've asked a very difficult thing. And then he says something really amazing. And I find this just jaw-dropping. Yet, if you see me when I'm taken from you, it will be yours. If you see me when I'm taken from you, it will be yours. Otherwise it will not. What on earth is that about? What is that about? It's one of those lines that we sort of read and pass on because, you know, it's just part of the silly story. No. I think this has got a real depth, and we need to sit with it. We need to explore what is going on here that Elijah knew when he said, "If you see me when I'm taken from you, it will be yours." What's going on? Elijah says, "You've asked me a very difficult thing. Yet if you see me when I'm taken from you, it will be yours." Very interesting. Through the gospel, through the scriptures, this phrase keeps returning. Deuteronomy. "To this day the Lord has not given a mind that understands, or eyes that see, or ears that hear." In Mark, Jesus says, "Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear." This whole little phrase of, if you have ears to hear and eyes to see, you will have something. And it's about the spiritual life. In Romans, Paul says, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that could not see and ears that could not hear because of their stubbornness and their refusal to engage with the richness of the spiritual things that God was laying before them. So there's something in this phrase about, yet if you see me when I'm taken from you, it will be yours. I don't think he's talking about, will you actually see the chariots fly off? I don't think he's talking about that. I think we're into a different, this is a spiritual story. All the scriptural stories are spiritual stories. They're stories of people's experiences with God. That's what the scriptures are about. They are stories of people's experiences with their God. This is an experience of someone's encounter with God. So it's a deeply spiritual. And I'm prepared to say, Elisha, in this moment, had a deeply mystical experience. Now, I'll come back to that word. So he then, we'll just come back to that. So then Elisha picks up the cloak that had fallen from him and stood to the bank of the Jordan. He took the cloak that had fallen from Elijah, and he struck the water with it, saying, I hear disgust. I hear disgust in this little phrase. So where now? He's gone. Where now is this God of Jacob? Is it panic? Is it disgust? Is it fear? Is it uncertainty? Is it lostness? What is it? Could be any of those. He then takes the cloak and he strikes the water, and he has this amazing experience of seeing what he describes as the waters dividing, the affirmation. So not only does Elisha have a deeply spiritual experience, something related to, do you see? Are you seeing what's going on here? But he goes through the normal human experience of having to test it out. How many times have we had deeply spiritual experiences? And the first thing we say is, oh, you'll think I'm weird, but... Or I wonder where that is in the scripture. I'll make sure that what happened was real. Without connecting deeply with what we know. Because I think God touches our heart personally, intentionally, lovingly, and we can know it. That's the affirmation in this story. It's affirming what we know. But we also know we're human, so we have to test it out. And that's what Elisha does. And in that moment, somewhere between, if you see me when I go, and striking the water, something happens. Something happens in Elisha. Something profound, that means afterwards he was different. Afterwards he was changed. And so then the story goes on, which I think is just the most adorable ending to this story, really. All the fans gather around. All Elisha's fans, all Elisha's entourage. Cannot be true. Cannot be true. Someone's taken him. He's gone. He must be hiding. Who will go and find Elijah and restore what should be our leader, our prophet? And so this group of fans comes together. Because Elisha has had this profound experience, he's able to say, don't send them, no need. But those who have not had the profound experience will still argue, will still want the proof, will still want to know what went on. They want the head knowledge, they want the certainty. No, 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 we'll go. Okay, off you go. And then they come back. 3 days, but they did not find him. And when they returned to Elisha, who was staying in Jericho, he said to them, I told you so. Isn't that adorable? Talk about humour in the scripture. So this something profound that happens to Elisha, I'm calling a deeply mystical experience, because it profoundly changed him enough to be able to sit in this place of alternate reality, if you like, of oppositional, of but the what ifs or the maybes or out there's another way of thinking about this. No, I can sit where I know what is true, and what is true is that I have been deeply touched and deeply changed by God, and that God initiated this. Because whether or not there were chariots of fire, we'd have no idea. Probably not. It's not our normal experience, not my normal experience, to see people disappear in chariots of fire. But there's a reason for this story that is about what happens when God gives you and touches you so deeply in this way. It's through the scriptures. I think Moses had a mystical experience in front of a bush. I think Peter and John had a mystical experience on top of a mountain. I think Paul had a mystical experience on the way to Damascus. We could go on and on. And in each case, who they were afterwards was deeply and profoundly different from who they were before. God did something within their spirit that not only gave them faith, but changed their whole way of being. The way they went about in the world, it changed everything. Best example is Paul, from the accuser to the apostle. Couldn't have it clearer. We don't know too much more about Elisha, so we don't know too much about what that outcome was. But it's about the story, isn't it? It's about this fact that if you have eyes to see, if you have ears to hear, what's that about? The still, small voice of calm that's in here. And when we listen to that and when we look at our experiences and we see them with the eyes of faith, God can profoundly move us and change us. Luke 10. Just something that Jesus is talking about. Jesus, a profoundly spiritual man. Talk about understatement. Deeply connected. He knew. And he says, "Blessed are the eyes that see what you have seen. Blessed Elisha, that you saw something in Elijah, that you picked up, that you encountered. Blessed are the eyes that see what you have seen. For I tell you that many prophets and kings desired to see what you see, but did not, and to hear what you hear, and did not." Why not? Why don't we all see this? Why don't we all live in this profoundly spiritual, centered place? The impact on our world would be astounding. It would be astounding if we lived out of this place, if we all lived out of this place. Why not? Why don't we see? Why don't we engage it? Ego? Ambition? Politics? Go on, name all the rest of the horrors in the world. Mostly it's about fear. If I do, and if I do live out of this deeply spiritual place, what happens? Who will reject me? Who will think I'm weird? What opposition do I have to face? How do I face that? Myriad things. And then in Psalm 66... another wonderful, wonderful phrase that I personally love out of the scriptures, where in the midst of all this horror and this oppositional world in which the psalmist is living, and I have to say it feels pretty real at the moment. We live in a pretty terrible place. I mean, we don't. We are incredibly blessed and it's beautiful. It's just gorgeous. But we're not struggling to find food under the rubble of an earthquake in rural Afghanistan. We're not struggling to find our relatives who have died in floods in Bangladesh and India. We're not struggling with the bombs and the horrors of war. The psalmist must have known something of that. Said, "For you, O God, have tested us. You've tried us with silver, you brought us into the net, you laid burdens on our back, you let people ride over us, we went through fire and we went through water." Talk about a very current little line, that bit. We went through fire and we went through water. "Yet you have brought us out to a spacious place." What did the psalmist know? What did the psalmist know? "You have brought us out to a spacious place." He's not saying, "Oh, thank goodness I found a lovely green grassy pasture where these people can't find me." David found a cave to hide in so Saul couldn't find him. This is actually repeated in Psalm 18, and David's actually talking. It's probably David talking and repeating what he knew. "You brought us out into a spacious place." 2 Samuel says, "He brought me into a spacious place. He rescued me because he delighted in me." This is our God. Job, "He is wooing you from the jaws of distress to a spacious place." Psalm 18, "He brought me into a spacious place because he rescued me, because he delights in me." Psalm 31, "You have not given me into the hands of the enemy, but you have set my feet in a spacious place." What is this spacious place? Is it, "Oh, well, if I bless you, if you are blessed by God, then everything will be hunky-dory"? Well, we know that's not true, don't we? So there's something here about eyes to see, ears to hear, and it being associated with something deeply internal. The spacious place is here. This is the spacious place. That affirmation that we are safe in the arms of our God, that we are held by God, that we are at one with our God, and that God leads us and gives us these profound experiences of certainty and affirmation that every one of you knows. I can say that categorically. You wouldn't be sitting in this room if that wasn't the case. Every one of us knows that. The trick is how to live out of it. That's the trick. So the story of Elijah, I don't want to keep going too long. I tend to get a little bit passionate about these different stories, is that it's about having deeply spiritual eyes to see. So actually having the guts to say, no, this is of God. This isn't coincidence. It's not just something odd. It didn't just happen because the stars aligned. This is of God. To see what others didn't see or don't see or don't want to see or refuse to see. And to live in the confident spaciousness of the God of Elijah. To live in that confidence, inner spaciousness that we know that when we connect with God, we sit in God's gift of love, all is well and all will continue to be well. So what is the mantle all about? Because a lot of preaching about this passage will talk about the mantle. What is the mantle that you are going to take on? As if you're going to become CEO of Woodside, and so now you take on the mantle of leadership. I don't think that's what this story is about. I don't think he was passing on the commission to Elisha to become head honcho. I think it's much more deep than that. I think the mantle that Elijah saw and picked up metaphorically was what he saw of the deep, deep faith of Elijah and the exemplar that he had set before him. Elijah had lived a life of faith. He'd struggled. He's just come from running away from Jezebel and the Baal prophets who wanted to kill him, tell him he was a curse. He'd struggled. He'd faced all these oppositions the psalmists are talking about all the time. So he lived something. He lived out of this deep inner faith in his world of opposition. And Elisha could see it. Elisha was looking at the exemplar of this deeply spiritual life. I think that's the mantle that he was given the privilege of seeing. He saw it in here. He connected with it. I think that's really challenging. As I said, you know, the older you get, the more you think about what do I leave behind? What do I pass on? Has it been worthwhile? Is there anything that I've done that... And we get into the whole doing thing, don't we? The legacy is about what have you done? I think this story, and I want to talk about Beverly Lanzetta and her approach to it now. These stories are not about what have we done. They're about who have we been. Much more confronting. Much more. The mantle we pass on is who we are. The deep person of faith who is held to principles of compassion, of love, care for others, care for our world, welcoming, respecting all the things we know, all the things that come out of what is told to us in Galatians. Those who live a deeply spiritual life will exhibit all these characteristics. People see it. People know who you are. You know, it's one of the fallacies, isn't it, of human existence, to think that people don't see how we are. I'll tell you one of my other little... You can call me a heretic if you like, I don't mind. I think it's the gospel. I think it's the gospel. I think it's what Jesus came to teach us and to tell us, that when we are so deeply anchored in our love of God, people see and people know. They will know we are people of peace. They will know we are people of love. Do we have to tell it? If we have to tell them that, have we failed? Do we have the courage not to tell them, but to be it? And I think, therefore, I'd just very quickly go on to now touch on somebody who I've been reading about, who I think is trying to be this and is living a life like this. Beverly Lanzetta is an American theologian. She's had a long history. She's probably in her 70s by now. A long history of studying various world religions, comes out of a Christian tradition, but sees the wisdom of the work of God in all people's lives in all sorts of different ways. And I think one of the things that she's brought is this philosophy to what I've been talking about, and that is that whether or not you belong to a religion or are uninterested in religion, there is a divine path interior to your being. What we've been talking about is natural. Why is it natural? We're created by the same God. It's organic, an organic constellation of the wisdom that's imprinted on your soul. You don't learn this stuff. You have to open your eyes and see it and hear it with the spiritual ears and the spiritual eyes. Ephesians, Paul talks about a beautiful line, with the eyes of the heart enlightened. Beautiful line in Ephesians. If you have the courage to advance into the mystery of your own solitude, you will discover it for yourself. So this theme that often comes with deeply connecting with our own spiritual self often is about finding a quiet, spacious place where you can allow that to just impact your soul. It's composed of its eternal nature. It cannot be lost, abandoned or forgotten. And I think one of the interesting things, certainly when I was younger, growing up, there was a phrase that was used in our context. People who left the church, we'd say, oh, they've lost their faith. I don't think you do that. I don't think God lets you go. And I think you cannot. You cannot lose the connection with God. You can reject it. You can say, no, thank you. You can go on your own way. And I think they're the people that Jesus is talking about and Paul's talking about who refuse to be connected with it. And in the secret teachings of love, you will be guided on a spiritual journey that forges a path to holiness in your being and in the world. So this fabulous line now, I hear a lot of, perhaps it's probably me saying it all the time, that's why I hear it. But so I've come in contact with this idea, this way of living. How now shall I live? That's the question. How now shall I live? It's one thing to say you believe. It's one thing to have the creed. It's one thing to sing beautiful songs. Gather together. Enjoy the moment. Be affirming of one another. Terrific. But we all know we have to go back into what's life. Question. Having done all this, how now shall you live? That's the crux of this. And I think that's the crux of what 1 Kings is about. It's about Elijah enlightening Elisha. How now are you going to live? Now that you've seen and had this experience. So she talks about the monk within. Now she's a very profoundly, well, I just keep saying spiritual person. She's profoundly committed to the spiritual life and living it in the world. So it's not monk in the version, in the sort of historical version of the last, 1500 years, where you hide away and have a life of prayer. Her thing is about being deeply connected to our inner space, but allowing that to be the platform from which you then live. So it's about connecting with the monk within us, because it's a private, spacious place. It's an intimate space. But it's not just for you. It's actually about it being the source, the wellspring for how we live when we go out into the world. So being a monk is not an attachment to an identity, but following the call within to honour the sanctity of creation, the miracle of spirit, and holding the divine presence in one's heart. Now, there are a lot of underlying theological considerations here, and one of them is, do you accept that you hold the divine presence in yourself, in your heart? Do you live as if that is the case? The divine presence within is the heart of what Beverly Lanzetta is talking about. And it's a commitment to be for other and not to self, which yearns to give away all that's petty, constricted or selfish in one's heart. Now, pretty high ideals, you know. You can look at people that have spent, like she spent 40 years developing her ideas. Not developing, affirming her ideas. And I think what it's come to, and I'll skip on a bit, I think, is this via feminina. And what she's saying is that in the history of Christianity, the history of spirituality, there's normally, classically, two ways that we come to be with God. One is way of silence, which would be the enclosed monk's world, or our own silent prayer. And the other is via positiva, which is what we do now here. The words, the external, the theology, the doctrines, what's very out there. What she's trying to do is to marry together, to perceive reality from a perspective that is implicit and intrinsic. So it's from within here. And her via feminina signifies a spiritual journey towards union with God. So again, in historical Christianity, whenever you read a lot of spiritual works, the goal is union with God. This wonderful phrase, union with God. And it's not union with God, like being on the chariots and going up to heaven. It's union with God. Am I and God at one, so that I may live out of that space? It's a spiritual practice and a way of life. And it's a holistic approach to spiritual life. I'm aware of being a little bit over time here, but these are the things that it weaves together. It's the secular and the sacred. I hate that dichotomy. Not part of my world anymore. What's secular? As if God doesn't live out there. No, it's not where we're at, is it? We're at with God in all things and God present in all places. and we and God are one in the midst of all that is. So she's addressing that. Now, there is only one. It loves the earthly realm with all of its life-affirming attributes. You want to be an environmentalist? Find your spiritual heart, because we love creation. It's the source and the content of a theology of embodied transcendence. That's a bit high-flowing. Has the capacity and responsibility to integrate spiritual wisdom into daily life and to strive to be divine-like. You know, again, if I go back in my spiritual history, one of the things that was common back then was being preached about sanctification. My goal in my Christian journey was sanctification, and I had this image of perfection and this image of being Christ-like that was untouchable, unreal, but keep trying and you'll get there. I don't find that really helpful now. I find this a lot more helpful, because in that desire to be at one with my God, the gifts of the Spirit, the fruit of the Spirit, will be evident. And they'll be evident in daily life. People will see it. People see it in you. People know it. And it has the capacity, to be wedded to the humanity, creation, cosmos, and to God in one, integrated as a vow. So she wants to be a monk within, so she's happy to vow her life to a certain perspective of the spiritual life. That's why she calls it a monk within. We don't have to use that language, but I'm very, very supportive of the direction that she's going. Very supportive. And then to see it with contemplative eyes, the true state of the world. I think that's something that I've been disturbed by recently. The state of our world. It's pretty hard to find a lot of great stuff out there. But the great stuff that I do see is usually about the people who are doing it. And why are the people doing it? Because they know something. They've seen something. And they've committed and vowed their life to it. And they're doing it. That's the mantle that I'm receiving when I see these wonderful exemplars of people who are committed to their inner faith. So finally, there's a whole lot of aspects to this that calls us to sink into the very depth of our being. It's non-dualistic. There is no them and us. There is only the world and the God who lives in the midst of it. It is about love. It is about respect. It's about the welcome of the soul of the other. It's non-hierarchical. Hooray, that's why it's via feminina. It's not patriarchal. We've lived with patriarchy for 1800 years. We're into a different era where God is doing a new thing. And I think she's part of what that is. So I think it's deeper. It's a more hidden path. It's a more silent, non-dual path. It's a more intimate and non-violent path. It's radical love. It's radical mercy and surrender. It's a path of open-heartedness and guilelessness. It's a path that leads to the expansion of our full humanity. So how do you want to live? You want to live like that? Just a question. I think it's a challenge. Actually, I do think it's a challenge. To live out of this deep, inner place where all is one. Those of you who know Richard Rohr's work, everything belongs. God is in all things. And God is in us. So finally, the summation of that is that the single most distinguishing feature is its intimate wholeness. It wants to embrace and put us in a place of embracing the wholeness of our spiritual journey and our spiritual life. And it's a specific part of reconciliation that begins from a different premise of trust. And I love this word, indissoluble intimacy. Who can take it away from you? We think all sorts of things can, but they can't. It's ours. And we're so well connected to that inner place. So what is the mantle we are to take on? I won't answer that. I think that's our question. What is the mantle that we are going to take on? And what is it that we desire to be known for? As people of the Spirit, of people of faith, of people who know that they can live out of a space that will make a difference. I'll just finish with a poem from Noel Davis. I don't know if you know Noel Davis. He's an Australian poet, wonderful man, died last year. If you ever want some very reflective, deep poetry, he's terrific. So it's called A Thousand Times Over. I need to tell the world a thousand times over about the gift of silence, the intimacy of inner quiet, how it has been my healer, from someplace else awakening my seeing, helping me to relate my doing with my being, opening me up to be gifted by others, moving me each day to express my gratitude, drawing me ever closer to the heart of all and into the sanctuary of now. Into the sanctuary. This is today's stuff. This is not when I'm at the pearly gates and having to justify what I did all my life. This is living it now. That we live out of this deep, intimate place. And to me, the most profound line in that, helping me to relate my doing and my being. That's my challenge. How then shall you live? I have to work that out. But where do I begin from? I begin from my certainty and my confidence of my deep inner love, inner acceptance of the great God, the great living God. Let me just finish with one of Beverly Lanzetta's prayers here. So lead us, Holy One, to your temple. Help us to transform our hearts. And may your radiance illuminate the path of the monk who lives for you alone. Amen. Thank you.